was first privileged to speak from this sacred pulpit 10 years ago last week. 10 years represents a full act in a man's adult life. To continue the image, the milestone anniversary represents an occasion to mingle with old friends, have an intermission, and to be critical and analytic. Has the action been purposive or aimless? Has the conversation been vapid or constructive? Have we taken hold of life, made something of it, or simply reacted and existed? These, I presume, are the thoughts all of us share when we pass some such anniversary. The rabbi must add another judgment. Has the Judaism which he has been teaching been relevant? Is it useful? Is his faith up to date? Or has it only an antiquarian interest? And it is to this last question that I should like to address myself this morning. Now, chance had it that these last 10 years bridged two ages in the history of man. 10 years ago, the first Sputnik had not yet orbited around the Earth. The first laser beam had not penetrated into the dim recesses of outer space. Man was still earthbound. He had not yet broken the shackles of gravity. Well, the space age has hardly begun, but one fact is preeminently clear, and the evidence seems conclusive. There is no God up there. There is no God out there. Our astronauts, our radar, our telemetric photography have scanned the heavens, and reported on energy and on radiation, on the planets and on the stars, and without exception, they report no physical evidence of the presence of God. Now, some have assumed that since there is no God out there, there is no God, and that the science of our space age has finally laid to rest one of the most persistent and lingering of all human illusions. Well, at least this much is true. We can no longer hug to ourselves the welcome thought of a cosmic grandfather, benign and helpful, who watches over our destinies from some place beyond the stars. The God who appears to us from the golden background of those medieval altarpieces, the royal God, crowned and throned, seated above the stars, who judges the angels and man and who receives their petitions, this God, lo haya v'lo nivra, never was. He never had been. Whence came this image of God, this rather physical image of God? In all honesty, we must say that it came into Western faith when our stepdaughter religion, Christianity, compromised with the second commandment. The Bible insisted that God was wholly other, purely spirit, holy. Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image, nor any manner of likeness of anything that is in the heavens above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the waters under the earth. Thou shalt not bow down to them, nor serve them. Eager to convert the pagan world, Christianity compromised with many of the crude pagan faiths. And when she allowed the icon and the idol, the image and the stained glass and the statue to be brought into the sanctuary, she lent some weight of assurance to those who believed in a physical God. After all, they saw about them at worship his physical presence. Now, I have heard my people, our Jews, echo and parrot the denial of a disabused generation. There is no God up there, therefore there is no God. And I am moved to ask them, whoever taught them that there was a God up there, was this the teaching of Moses? Was this the teaching of Hillel? Was this the teaching of Akiba or of Maimonides or of any modern rabbi? One of the grand and glorious facts of our history is that our faith never compromised with a biblical image of God, an imageless God, a God beyond attribution, a God beyond description, the holy other God. I am that which I am. Thou canst not see my face. Ein lo demut haguf, ein no guf. God has neither form nor shape nor human apparition, nor any apparition at all. Stubbornly and consistently, Judaism has insisted that God cannot be defined or described. And when the psalmist said, lift up your eyes and high, he was not pointing to the place of God. Rather, he was pointing to the reflection of God, sketched and etched in the wonders and marvels of creation. Lift up your head and high and see who has created these. God is not creation, but creator. God is reflected in the sparkle and the miracle of creation, but he has no place, someplace out there in creation. God is not up there, but everywhere. God is not someplace, but every place. And no one who was at all a student of Judaism and who believed in our doctrine ever believed that one day there would appear on a radar screen the blips which would show the physical presence of God in the universe. But let us probe more deeply yet. As the space age banished God entirely from the realm of sensible discourse, there are many I know who believe that God is simply a convenient explanation of that which science has yet to explain. That as science leaps forward, God is in hot retreat. God is, in a sense, an accordion word, a word which describes a grand and glorious thing when man was a primitive and his science was rudimentary, but an accordion word which has become more and more meager, thinner, and less describing as science has advanced and pushed man's wisdom farther and farther into space. We have become accustomed, you and I, to believe that science undercuts religion. We believe it almost to be axiomatic that to believe, man must take a blind leap into the unreasonable. To those who believe so, put before them one of the strange and unexpected paradoxes of our modern science. And of recent times, as we have moved into a new awareness of our universe, science has lent confirmation, substantiation, to the very old and very ancient truths of our faith. No one expected it to be so. Science and religion had been at each other's neck, lo, these many centuries. But somehow science has rounded a corner. And amazingly, its new understanding of the universe lends comfort and confirmation to the old image. Recall for me and with me, if you will, for a moment, the science, the physics that you learned in your classroom. Remember the old iron laws of cause and effect? How the world was described to you as a vast and intricate mechanism, a self-winding watch, if you will, but infinitely complex. There was only apparent change in this universe, and there was complete predictability. All of energy, all of matter followed out certain iron, unbreakable paths and laws. There was no chance. All was determined and predetermined. Oh yes, we were told if we want to believe of God as the first cause of that which explains how all this came into being but really explains nothing, go ahead and believe it. But remember this, that this model of the universe allows you no credence If you assume that God directs human destiny, or that God listens to human prayer, or that God performs wondrous things. The world is sealed off, and God is an unmoved mover, holy other. Now many of us still carry about the remnants and the relics of this teaching, and we have not recognized that this model of the universe has been consigned to the scrap heap. A new model has emerged. The universe is no longer a mechanism, but an organism. The universe is no longer simply a predetermined acting out following laws of energy, but an emerging, vital, alive cosmos, thrusting forward, full of change, full of the unexpected, a universe which responds to an imprinted wisdom. There is in this new universe sudden leaps of energy. There is in this universe biologic mutation. There is in this universe change. There is in the universe an upward thrust from the simple to the complex, from gas to matter, from the inorganic to organic, from the animate to the inanimate to the animate, from the simplest forms of organisms, the virus and bacteria, to man. There seems to be imprinted upon this new universe not a law of predictability, not the iron shackles and change of cause and effect, but certain probabilities. And there is change. And there seems to be not only motion, but direction, emergence, the hand of God. The scientist and the man of faith unite today in reverence, in awe, for the imprinted wisdom of creation. Again, we can say with the ancient psalmist, the heavens declare the glory of God and the earth reveals his handiwork. Now, this is not to say that science proves God. God is clothed in wonder and in mystery. God is as far beyond the laboratory as he has been always beyond human logic. But this new model, which science has presented to us of our world, the model of a world in motion, moving towards, surging upward, breaking away, moving out, emerging. Surely this image of the world bespeaks an imprinted creative wisdom, bespeaks the hand and will and wisdom of God. We have spoken of God. Let us speak for a moment of man. There are some who believe that religion is simply the affirmation of God. Judaism, at least, is equally the affirmation of man. Over the long centuries, Judaism has stubbornly insisted against all the pessimisms and the fatalisms and the despair of the human race. Man is capable of great and grand things. Judaism has insisted on human capacity, on the saintliness, on the dignity that is within you. Judaism has insisted that you are not a slightly civilized beast, but created in the image of God. That if you have the will and the courage and the understanding, you can become but little lower than the angels. Now again, until very recent times, both experience and science argued against this radical affirmation of man. The dyspeptic could always find in his neighborhood evidence of human cruelty and human violence and of human pathology. And our science found that we were tied biologically to the lower beasts. And on this simple truth of evolution, they constructed a determinist psychology, which insisted that man cannot shake his nature any more than a leopard can change his spots. And we are creatures of impulse and of instinct, and that we cannot discipline these instincts. They are forever part of us. Our passions, our appetites, our lusts, our ambitions. But man remains beasts, remains beyond dignity and beyond saintliness, and that our world will always remain a dog-eat-dog jungle. And of course, this view of man seems to have received dramatic and shocking confirmation in our age. As we read of Dachau and of Majdanek and of Auschwitz, of Hiroshima and of Nagasaki, Selma, of Little Rock. The But again, the space age has lent a striking confirmation in its science and its learning to the ancient truth. For in this period of our history, when we have plumbed the depths of human depravity, slowly there has been forged in the laboratories of our civilization a new model of man. True, this man is tied biologically to the lower forms, but evolution somehow transformed, radically transformed life in man. Man is the first animal who can control his environment. Man is the first animal who can conceptualize and pass on his learning from generation to generation. Man is the first animal who has the discipline to control himself and who has devised a society which permits childhood, tender, loving years, adolescence, learning, the emergence of the human being from the animal infant. And today, the view of the Bible, the biblical psychology is receiving striking scientific confirmation. We are told that man is indeed made of rare stuff, that we have the capacity to love, to outgrow our baser impulses, to outgrow our violent compulsions, to become respected, respectable, dignified, decent. And our new science is teaching us how the environmental forces of cultural deprivation, the slum, inadequate education, the broken home, the lack of love, the lack of opportunity, all those have conspired through the years to keep most men from realizing their human potential. The animal child grew into an animal man because he had no opportunity to be human. And a new science is describing for us and discovering for us therapy and cure, whereby the possessed and the disturbed and the distraught, who have so often convulsed our society, can be healed, and our society spared their onslaught. Again, ideas forged by our ancestors in a flash of genius 3,000 years ago, way back in the Iron Age of history. Again, these ideas are receiving striking confirmation. 10 years ago, when a rabbi spoke of God having created man after his own image, there were many who smiled indulgently at this bit of poetic exaggeration. Today, the scientist, the human scientist, and the biblical scientist share a common understanding of man. The biblical philosophy stands vindicated, but modern man is yet to meet the test. For the Bible is not only a faith, a set of principles, a philosophy, but it is a mandate, a challenge, a responsibility. We have yet to show that we can abide the biblical responsibility. Wash it. Make you clean. Put away the evil from before mine eyes. Cease to do evil. Learn to do well. Seek justice. Relieve the oppressed. Judge the fatherless. Care for the widow. The biblical philosophy stands confirmed. The biblical philosophy of man, its psychology, is again creditable. But take this to heart. The biblical history is also creditable. The prophets taught, and they taught forcibly. They taught a generation which would not listen. Those that were at ease in Zion preferred to follow after the stubbornness of their own hearts. Israel preferred to be active in the political arena of its day, to be politically ambitious, to be domestically unconcerned. And ultimately, the clash of rich and poor within, the social turmoil, and the maelstrom of politics without sealed Israel's doom. You know, whenever I talked of the prophets over the past 10 years, men thrilled to their exalted moral vision. But they balked at the impending sense of doom which is written large in every line of prophecy. The Lord God, the prophet said, doth roar from the heavens. We don't like to think of the nightmare thoughts. Do not our plains today roar aloft every hour of the day, bearing in their bellies the weapons of ultimate destruction. And are they not buried into the earth in silos and under the sea in submarines? The atomic-headed missiles which are capable of destroying our earth, does not the Lord again roar from the heavens? The hour is late. And we can read today in 1965 the sense of doom and of urgency, with a new sense of its appropriateness. We talk about it, don't we? Endlessly. And yet you and I continue, by and large, to live as if we were any other place but at the brink of disaster. The mind has an infinite capacity to block the unwanted thoughts. We are on a plane and the pilot announces a serious malfunction of an engine, and we worry for a moment or two, and then we find ourselves in idle and aimless talk with our neighbor. On the plane we are helpless. We are in the hands, and then we depend upon the skill of the pilot. But in life we are not helpless. There is no fate, there is no destiny, save the destiny which we ourselves make. Would you have peace? Your hands and your heart and your action can create it. Would you have prosperity? You and I and we together can establish it. Man is not fated. There is no final destiny etched for us someplace up there in the skies. We create our destiny, we and all who share this earth with us. We face a future which is filled with foreboding, with anxious thoughts. But you know, we face also a future unparalleled in its promise. Our science has again come to our aid. It has broken from off the necks of mankind the ancient yoke of poverty, which despoiled life and destroyed opportunity, and kept most men meaningless, hapless beasts of burden. We have immunized ourselves and our children against most of the crippling and of the devastating diseases, and we can look forward confidently to the 40 years of life. Our bins are full, no stomach need be empty, no man's vigor need be unnecessarily sapped. We have found resources of energy which promise us warmth and transport long after the crude resources within the earth have been exhausted. The promised land. It's just beyond the horizon. The prophetic image of a time of peace and of sunshine, when every man would sit under his vine and under his fig tree and none would make him afraid, was no more than a bit of poetic exaggeration. Today, our governments are busy legislating the great society. It is achievable. It can be ours. Thrice blessed are we and blessed again. No mother need fear childbirth. No child need lack for an education. No man need break his health to earn a living. Thrice blessed are we and blessed again. There is no disease which we may not ultimately conquer. Thrice blessed are we and blessed again, but thrice burdened are we and burdened again. The need is for an heroic moral courage. The ancient standard, live and let live. Mind your own business and I'll mind mine. It's the surest way to contort our promise and to convert it into a curse. The time is short. Population uncontrolled can gobble up our abundance and return the majority of men into the cruel yoke of poverty. Those prejudices which we half cherish to ourselves are ready welcome and ready weapons in the hands of those who wish to protect their sacred privilege and their ancient powers. And they use us for their selfish ends. All that we have, all that golden future which lies out there just behind the horizon, can be distorted, brutalized, raise a generation which lacks adequate education and they will quickly become the minions of some tyrant and demagogue who will play on their fears and on their scraps of learning, and controlling as he will now control new techniques of thought control of the engine for the engineering of propaganda. It will be hard to loose his boot from on the neck of man. There is great promise, and there is great danger. The Lord doth roar from the heavens, and man needs to roar in response his commitment to the good, to the necessary, to the urgent, to service, to his community, to responsibility, to peace, to a life beyond that of his selfish. It is necessary sense. The ancient truths, my dear friends, have proven out. Man has yet to prove himself. We have it in our power to construct a grand and glorious society. But there is no assurance that we will do so. Most of us are still timid saints. Most of us are half-hearted in our virtues, even as we are half-hearted in our vices. And I'm afraid that the new age requires far more of us than a rearguard action against every social change. I'm afraid that the new age requires our service and not only that of our children. I'm afraid that the new age requires us to give up our privilege and to share only in the privilege of citizenship. I'm afraid that the new age requires of us that we seek to assume that we can build the instrumentalities of peace by building the instruments of war. I'm afraid that the new age requires a radical transformation of our attitudes towards our neighbors, towards men of other races, towards those of other classes, to those of other nations. We must accept a world of change, a violent world, and lend to that world our understanding and our vision. And you and I have an especially sacred mission. The prophet Isaiah speaks of a time when 10 men shall come unto every Jew and shall say, "The Lord is with you. Teach us his way." We who have been blessed for lo these many years with this ancient truth, we who understand fundamentally its dimensions, we who know what it means to believe in God and to believe in man, we who understand the fundamental moral mandate of citizenship and of selflessness, we must find for ourselves disciples. We must lead by noble example. It is not enough to live and to let live. It is not enough to do our business, to raise our family, to give to the various appeals of our community. It is good, but it is not enough. This is an age in crisis. Time is late. God is urgent. God demands a service of you. Service of the heart. Service of your life. I pledge this to you that in the next decade I will use every skill I possess in this service. And I ask that you join with me in testifying to God before man, in testifying to the ancient truths before our generation. Amen.